This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Dr. Martha Brooks. Today is 14-15, January 2013. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Martha is joining me from her home in Newark, Delaware. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning.
I'm really glad, like I said before, to have the opportunity to interview you. Obviously, we interviewed your husband, Tim, a few months ago for the Oral History Project, and it's nice to have someone who can corroborate, I guess, some of the things about Tim's experiences, and most importantly, of course, about yours. To begin the interview, can you tell me some biographical information? Can you tell me when you were born and where?
Okay, I was born on November 20, 1945, in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, where the hospital was, but I grew up in a town called Linden Center, Vermont, which is just north of St. Johnsbury, in the northeast corner of Vermont.
What were your parents' names?
Dorothy and Morris Hill.
And what did they do for a living?
My mother was a full-time mom, and my dad ran a small company that basically did kind of two things. One, it did a lot of home finishing work, like selling windows and doors and things like that and installing them, and then also did a lot of woodworking, packaging kinds of things that were made out of wood products in northern Vermont. So.
A beautiful country to grow up there.
Yes, it was. It was a classic small town grow up years.
Now, did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have an older brother and two younger sisters.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a nice sized family. Mm-hmm. Well, you just briefly mentioned a few moments ago the kind of the setting of northern Vermont. I've been up there a number of times, and even to St. Johnsbury and Linden Center and places like that. Really idyllic kind of setting, New England kind of setting. Tell me about what it was like for you to grow up in that part of the world.
Well, like I say, it was a great place to grow up. I, you know, was able to walk to school. We lived in the town, and my elementary school was like not even a quarter of a mile away from our house, and then the high school was only maybe half a mile at most. So I walked to school my entire life, never had to ride a bus. Knew everybody in the town, and I guess that also means everybody knew who I was. So, you know, it's that kind of small town. You don't get away with anything. I don't know. It was, you know, so different than what kids look like. I could ride my bike anywhere. I could walk around in the woods without worrying about anything. I could, it was a pretty good, you know, 50s kind of lifestyle. For the post-war years. I was born right at the end of World War II, and it was, everybody was just, you know, everything like the, you read about the 50s was certainly going on there.
Right. You mentioned the Second World War. Was your father or any members of your family involved in the war?
I have, both of my uncles were, my father was blind in one eye, and so had never been called up. He did have to work in a factory in Lindenville that was making war-related stuff. I don't know exactly what it was, a tap and dye company, and he worked there the entire length of the war, even though he had his own company with his dad at that point. And my mom used to say that if they had gone through one more round of having to pull up soldiers, they would have pulled him in, even with the one eye, for something, because they were getting that far, but fortunately the war came to end. I did have two uncles who both served in the war.
Mm-hmm.
One on either side of my mother's brother and my father's sister's husband.
Now, growing up in the post-war years, was military service or even public service something that your parents encouraged? Did they talk about? Was it something that was understood as to, you know, something that the children should do when they grow up? Was that part of the environment?
Not so much the military part of it in my family, though that certainly was never put in any kind of not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that war was not a particularly good thing was kind of evident to people after World War II, but not the soldiers were held in very high esteem. And my dad was very active in local politics. He was on the school board. He was, real active in community kinds of things, and that was, you know, something that was certainly thought of highly in our family.
Mm-hmm.
So, And my mom was, hers were more church-related things and things like that, but they did a lot of outreach kinds of stuff.
Right. Tell me about school there in Vermont. Tell me about the kinds of things you enjoyed doing, the subjects you enjoyed, whether sports were part of the picture. What was it like growing up in school there?
Well, my elementary school was small. I mean, I went through until, I think it was somewhere around seventh grade before, we were always like two, like it'd be first and second grade together, second and third, to get like to 25 to 30 kids. So it was a pretty small school at that point. It was post, I mean, we were kind of the very beginning of the baby boom. I was born, I'm not, technically not a baby boomer because I was born at the very end of 1945, but the numbers of kids started to really increase fairly dramatically. So by the time I left my elementary school, the grades that the school had been added onto, and every grade had its own classroom and all that. But as I was going through, it was like I always had double classes. So we were either the oldest or the youngest in the grade until seventh and eighth grade. And it was all in elementary school, so we went through grade eight all in the same school. And it was, I think, a pretty decent basic education when I look back on it. It was very Dick and Jane. I mean, it wasn't an educator, so I was kind of into reading stuff later on and realized that probably wasn't the best way to teach me how to read, but I did eventually learn. And we had, because it was small, you knew people, and our teachers, I had a couple of teachers along the way that really encouraged our imaginations and let us write our own plays and do things that were, I think, a lot of fun. That those are the things I remember about my elementary years. The bad part of it probably was you had the same group of friends, and when you were getting along with them, that was great, and when you weren't, that was a little tough, but, you know, I pretty much managed most of the time to get along with them, so it worked out okay. That's kind of was elementary school. Then when we went to high school, our high school was, I graduated with the largest class that ever had graduated at that point, and it was 92 kids. So the kids came in from a variety of different elementary schools to the high school. It was, Linden Institute is one of those rare anomalies that is actually a private school that serves as the public high school for the town. And all the little towns, and then there were actually a small dorm that where some of the kids that came from towns that didn't have high schools would come. And we actually even got a couple of kids from other places in the country. It's since now it is a very big school, especially for skiers and things. A lot of kids come there from all over the country who are into either cross country or downhill skiing. But at that point, that was kind of like not a big motivator. We had a lot of skiing going on, but it was still, it was more local kids from towns outside of our area that were too far away to, you know, to take a bus kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a neat mix of kids that came together in high school. And let's see, what would I remember about high school? I was active in a lot of stuff, but I was never really what you'd call a star at anything. I refer to myself as everybody's favorite bench warmer. They liked me along on trips, but I only got to play when it was, we were pretty far ahead. But again, it was like, you just did those things. I mean, it wasn't, everybody was involved in, or most everybody was involved in something. Because that's the only way you could get a team was to have everybody kind of helping out.
Right.
I think in Texas they understand that.
Well, yes.
Some of your small towns.
that's exactly right, for sure. Now, in addition to this this Norman Rockwell-esque kind of...
Right. Sounds that way, doesn't it?
It does, kind of a setting there. I guess the dominant feature geopolitically at the time was the Cold War. Being born in 1945, you would have grown up, obviously, the 40s, the 50s, and into the 1960s with this as the dominant feature of that part
of the
world's environment. What do you remember about the Cold War?
Well, I do remember the getting under our desks practices, the drills. And I can remember wondering, what in the world good is this going to do us if somebody decides they're dropping a bomb on us? But I do remember that we would have these, just like the fire drills, you would have these everybody under their desk drill. I remember as I became older, my father was very political, and he was extremely conservative and became more conservative the older he got. And I kind of, so I was brought up in a very conservative kind of thinking way, though I have to say, even though looking back on it now, and I'd love to have him around to talk to him about it a little bit more, he was actually in some ways very liberal. I mean, he really was a reach out, help people person, so it kind of worked against each other a little bit. But that was kind of the, you know, the politics were Republican.
Right.
All the way. I mean, they were big Eisenhower fans and Nixon fans, and all the way up through there, that was where the politics in my family was. And my dad loved to talk about it, and we would have these dinner conversations where he would, you know, kind of lead the discussion about what was happening and not happening. And it was always, like I say, I was brought up with a pretty conservative leaning background from that perspective. Not necessarily from what I was getting in school, but from what I got home.
Right. And I know that you're a self-proclaimed news junkie. Would it be fair to say this is kind of where this started your awareness?
Yeah, I would say you're probably right about that. I was reading through some of my diary in preparation to kind of bring back, and I was surprised at how often I mentioned in there, you know, reading the news, watching the news, cutting out things to send to Tim, and that kind of stuff. That definitely comes from, reading the learning, well, not so much that I did it as a kid, but and I can't tell you when I really started reading the paper on a regular basis, but I certainly was by the time I was an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And that very much was, I mean, we had two papers in our home every day, and I think my parents actually got the Sunday Times. Just looking back on it now, so it wouldn't have made it to Vermont until probably early the next week.
That would have been my guess, yeah. Well, it certainly sounds like it was a very active and aware politically kind of environment in which you grew up.
Yeah. Now, and actually, my dad was elected to the National School Board when I was in probably 8th or 9th grade. And so my parents at that point started doing quite a bit of traveling because the meetings were held all around the country. And they had always made somewhat of an effort to travel with us. We had done a couple of trips growing up, which were very unusual because very few of my friends had been outside of the state. I mean, and maybe to New Hampshire, which was 30 miles away. But in terms of trip travel, very little of it. And we didn't do a lot, but we did some. And my grandparents, my mother's family, lived in New Jersey. So we went there at least twice a year. And I would get into New York City, and so I had a little bit of exposure to the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And for my high school graduation trip, they took me to they had a meeting in Denver, and I got to actually my first flight. So
by the time
I went to Boston for college, I had a little bit of exposure to life outside of Vermont and the Norman Rockwell Center setting.
Right.
And what really tuned me into that is I worked for my dad one summer in high school, in a very boring job, but this lady that worked there, they closed the whole place down for a week for vacation in the summer. And what this lady, who I got to know because she'd worked there forever, what she was going to do with her week's vacation was clean her house, and she had never, ever traveled outside of where she lived, which would be the greater Lindenville kind of area. And that just absolutely blew my mind. And then I would listen to people talk, and that was not uncommon. People just didn't do a lot of traveling, too far from home. So I realized that what the experiences I was getting were a little bit unique.
What year do you graduate high school, Martha?
1963.
In 1963. All right. Now, growing up in a household, again, that is aware and active in politics and things in local society, local community, I should say, 1963, of course, pretty important year.
We even
go back to 1960. Now, as a pretty well-educated and aware young lady as you were, what was your opinion of the Kennedy years?
My view of the Kennedy years was I was certainly not a supporter when I graduated in 1960. That was not a good thing. We were going to elect this liberal. By the time he was assassinated in 1963, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was November of 63.
Right.
Yeah. And I had been at college for several months. I mean, that whole experience was very, it's one of those that, you know, they always say you can close your eyes and know exactly. I was in my biology lab when it happened, and we got the word that it had happened. And I had a lot of friends who had, at that point in college, freshman year in college, in the dorm and stuff, and it was extremely traumatic. I mean, that's to have that happen. You know, what's going to happen to our country? What happened? All of that stuff was just very mesmerizing. And we got sent home early because it was just before Thanksgiving break, and we got sent home. I think 2 days early that year. Our vacation started 2 days early, and then when we came back, of course, they were going through all the stuff that followed it, and. So it was just a very big part of our lives. And that, watching that was when I first began to really think, well, maybe there's, you know, I need to start thinking a little more about what I believe in. And of course, that's college, too. That's what you do in college.
Sure. Hopefully.
And I think I started my slow, it didn't happen overnight, move toward looking at the world in a slightly different way than maybe I had been brought up to look at the world. But then again, I told my father when he realized I'd turned into a little liberal, he said, what did I do wrong? And I said, no, it's actually what you did right. You taught me how to think. So.
You mentioned college here. Where did you go to college?
I went to Simmons College. It's a women's college in Boston, Massachusetts, right in the heart of the city.
And you started there, I guess, in 63?
63, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, describe for me, if you will, the environment. What was it like there on the campus of Simmons College? What kind of
education? It was a very unique experience for me because I'd gone to, obviously, to co-ed schools all the way through high school. And in looking back on it, I'm not a big supporter of single-sex education, but I have to say that for me it worked out really well. I did much better not having men in the classroom. I became more confident in terms of speaking out or, you know, asking questions, being and again, I don't think I would have seen that had I not had that experience to realize that. And so over the 4 years, I think it really, I had opportunities for leadership. I served as a dorm counselor for a year. I was our dorm president for a year. I was involved in a number of activities on campus that just kind of gave me a little bit of confidence that I had some degree of ability to lead, to manage, to be a more active participant outside of what would have clearly been relatively traditional roles for women. I didn't go far from, I originally was going to be a nurse, because Simmons had a very strong nursing program. It was one of the reasons I went. In fact, it was the reason I picked the school, was to apply in the first place because of their nursing program. And by the end of my freshman year, and I couldn't piss my frog, I said, you know, I'm not really sure that nursing is what I want to do. And what I wanted to do and all along was I was going to be a pediatric nurse. I wanted to work with kids. And so I switched to their education program and have never regretted that decision. It was a good one for me. Years later, when our son was in the hospital and they were bringing him back from his surgery and I managed to faint, it kind of became pretty clear to me that Martha probably would have done really well in a hospital setting. I ended up going there because I wanted to be a nurse, and more than it was. And it was in the heart of Boston. I wanted a city experience. That was the other big motivator. I had choices. I had was accepted at a couple of other schools that had pretty decent nursing programs too. But I wanted the city, and that I never have regretted. I really enjoyed my 4 years.
Now, you mentioned that the single-sex education maybe wasn't something high on your list, or since that time hasn't been something you're all that crazy about, but you said that it gave you opportunities to speak out and to be involved in different kinds of leadership, which you mentioned you alluded to.
Which I may have gotten to anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because you go one way and you don't know.
Sure.
I just know that in high school, I was always, we had a very, in my class in high school, a very strong group of young men. Who were our leaders, and we got to be their girlfriends, and so we were part of it, and we, you know, that stuff all came in and out of it, but it was like I never really felt like I could push back. I had a couple of girlfriends who were, you know, you would definitely say were leaders in the class. And I was part of that group, but I certainly was not a leader within that group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying, is it was that transition to not having men around for a little bit. I didn't have to do the girl thing.
Right.
I don't know how to describe it. Your wife might understand. But actually, I don't know, because I think that was, we were going through that transition from the 50s to the 60s, where when you look at what happened for women, is a very huge transition time. So, and I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I could have gone on, if the world hadn't changed, I probably could have turned into my mother pretty easily. So.
Right. Well, I think that's probably certainly true of a lot of folks, of a lot of women.
Yeah.
And going to a somewhat of a liberal, larger city like Boston, and then there you are, separated from a lot of those things for the more traditional background. I think your experience probably mirrors the experience of many women, think, in the 1960s, for sure.
I would agree.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the years I was in college, it was the years I went there, and Simmons had very rigid rules. By the time I left 4 years later, we had no rules. I mean, that was what was going on in the 60s in college.
Well, give me some examples of that, Martha. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's very traditional, strict kind of roles, but you say that it loosens up toward the end.
More than loosened.
Explain
that.
Literally,
we had no, you know, there were all kinds of parole hours as freshmen. We had 2 Sundays a year where guys could come in your room. By the time we left, they were there all the time.
Hmm.
It was... And then what we did, what I did miss, and this I don't regret at all, but the drug stuff really didn't hit in the 4 years I was in college, at least in my environment. I know it was growing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you would hear about it, you would see some evidence of it, but it was pretty much the only drug that I ever ran into in college was alcohol. And I don't ever remember being even offered marijuana or any of that until... much later.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and then, and I'm not sorry about that. I think that probably was a good thing.
Sure, sure.
But it was. I mean, that's what the 60s and early 70s were all about. And it was that the baby boom generation coming of age and making a big noise.
Right. I wonder if you might remember any of the particular things that kind of led to this liberalization. It's one thing to speak in generalities. Well, you know, these kinds of things were changing. But were there any specific instances of things?
Yeah, I've often told this story. In my freshman year, I actually signed up to work for Barry Goldwater in the Young Republican Club at Simmons College. And I went out one time to this fundraiser thing to do. I can't remember what we were doing, handing out leaflets or whatever. And I went with this young woman who was a classmate of mine and whom I knew, very lovely young woman. And apparently her father was a very in person somewhere in the Republican Party. I don't know if it was in Massachusetts or whatever. But people just fawned over her. And she was very attractive, but it wasn't just that. She was Mr. Nelson's daughter. And apparently that was... So she got all this preferential treatment, and I kind of got shuffled out in the back room kind of thing, and it was like, wait a minute, this isn't how the world's supposed to be. We're both here, you know, working. It wasn't anything she did. She was just as nice as she could be, but it was like, oh, wait a minute. They really, it's not what we're doing. It's who you are. And so that was one thing that I remember very distinctly, and after that I was not quite so anxious to be a good little Republican because I didn't think they really wanted me to be a good little Republican. They wanted, because my dad wasn't rich enough. And again, the other things that would have had a real impact on that was watching the discussions that you have in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, those weren't just at Simmons. Those were like when we would go, I met Tim sophomore year in college, and I started spending a lot of my weekends at Bowdoin College in Maine. And they would have a lot of periodic discussions about stuff. And then the other big one, I think it was my junior year, I took the U.S. history course from a guy who was pretty well known in U.S. history across the country. And it was such an eye-opener for me. I had taken U.S. history senior year in high school, but it was still all the rose-colored glass stuff. Mm-hmm. We can do no wrong. You're looking at every event in history from the good old American, we're always right perspective. And all of a sudden, I was getting the same history, but with a variety of views on that history of how it might have happened, what were some of the players that were going on. And I can remember that, to this, like, my God, why didn't I get some of this when I was in high school? Why am I all of a sudden waking up to the fact that all of these events that have happened had multiple perspectives? And that. So it, when I look at courses over my life that made a big difference, that was definitely one of them.
Hmm.
So those were some examples of how it all happened. The other part of it is I went into education, and I did my student teaching in a very lower middle class school in Cambridge, and I took the subway to school every, or the, what do they call the bus, MTA,
the T,
to school every morning, and I worked with these kids who were not particularly well off, very blue collar school, and I had a chance, like I said, I had two student teacher or two master teachers that I worked with, one in second grade and one in fifth grade, I think it was. And the one of them was everything you don't want to be as a teacher, and the other one was kind of a semi-good teacher, not a great teacher, but at least a good teacher. And it was, again, that kind of exposure to a variety of different environments, because we'd gone through some other training programs junior year in high school, in college, to get ready for the student teaching part of it, that were also just kind of illuminating to see the differences in communities and the quality of education that kids were getting. So that kind of began to open up my eyes. Something jumping back to high school, in my junior year summer, I had an opportunity to work for 8 weeks at a camp for, it was called Silver Towers Camp for Retarded Children. And which shows you how 50s it was, but, or it's actually, yeah, that would have been the early 50s. And that was, again, for me, an absolutely wonderful experience. It was my first time of really being away from home for an extended period of time. And so I wasn't that far away from home, but I was living at the camp, and I was a junior counselor there the first year, and then a senior counselor the second year. And it was just a wonderful experience, and I loved the folks I was working with, and kind of eventually steered me in the direction I ended up going, which is special education. So that also, all of those kinds of experiences along the way began to expose me to the fact that not everybody had an easy time of it, and that there were a lot of barriers that came up in life that said, you know, we need to be looking at how we as a country support all kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say that all of those things together, plus probably 100 more if I thought about it long enough,
sure.
But just over time. And then I do. I really, I mean, it was funny. My father thought of us, all three of us girls, as very, you know, he was educating us to be good wives and mothers. And I think the fact that all three of us have been career women, and so he told me not long before he died that he really was proud of me. But on the other hand, he couldn't, you know, it was like, it was such a different world for him. That,
right. Well, the generational differences obviously can be difficult, and one's definition of good is different from another definition of good, obviously.
Right.
But yep. this clearly is a time that it's an important time of transition for you, and this is what is supposed to be happening in your late teens and your early 20s, trying to figure
that's
things
right.
out.
That's right. It's very, very
and being
much
educated
so.
While you still can be educated before you know
yep.
everything.
Yeah.
Now, you also mentioned that you met your future husband, Tim Brooks,
yep.
and this was your sophomore year, so it would have been, what, 1965, something like that?
Yes.
And Tim
February was of 1965.
February
coming 65. Up on our 48th anniversary of
Is
meeting.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. And he was going to Bowdoin, I believe you said,
yes.
a hockey player, as I recall.
Yep.
Now, also 1965, we have what's going on in Southeast Asia is beginning to beginning to grab a lot more headlines than it had in the past. And obviously,
mm-hmm.
this is something that grew very, very slowly and continued to built. But in 65 is kind of the year we mark as being the official American involvement in terms of ground forces,
yeah,
et cetera.
You're right.
How aware were you of Cold War policy in general, in particular what was going on in Southeast Asia?
Well, I mean, I can't tell you exactly at what point. I mean, I certainly was aware of the Cold War politics and, you know, stopping the spread of communism, which was, I think, the original, at least the verbal reason for why we were engaging in Vietnam at all. I'm trying to think. It certainly, as we moved through our junior and then into our senior year, it became more and more relevant because of the potential military impact. And I had one of my best friends in college ended up getting married in January of our senior year, and because in Massachusetts, that they were from Massachusetts. And that would give her then fiance, quicker than expected husband, a deferment. And so there was an awful lot of that stuff going on. Now, whether I clicked in on it in 1965, I can't tell you. But I certainly know that by the time we were juniors and seniors, it was very much a part of our lives, in part because of the draft and what it was doing to the young men we were falling in love with.
What was your opinion of the policies that were taking place?
Well, I have to confess, I voted for Richard Nixon the first time.
Hmm.
I didn't the second time, but I did the first time. And he promised to get us out of that war, and never did quite make it. So I guess I kept. I probably would have to say at that point that I was thinking that getting out of it was the right thing to do, but not. I certainly wasn't a protester at that point in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, what about the campus environment? What was it like on the campus there?
It was.
In Boston?
We were just a little bit before that stuff really began. You the seeds were there. You were starting to hear the talk of it. Again, it was definitely a conversation, but the protests and stuff really didn't get going until you were into 68, 69,
mm-hmm.
And I was out of college by that point.
What about your professors? Did you hear any of your professors discussing the merits of American involvement?
No. I other than that one course that I had where we actually spent very little, because like any U.S. history course, we have so much history now, we hardly ever get to the research.
Yes,
and so I'm sure they did, but we didn't have a lot of interaction with our professors outside of classes.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't run into that kind of, until I was in my doctoral program, where I really began to feel like I was friends with professors and that it was anything more than strictly a teacher-student dialogue that was going on. I would have to say, in my master's program, I did start to get some increasing number of courses that became very relevant and were much more challenging in terms of making you do the work as opposed to being fed stuff. But my undergraduate courses were, for the most part, pretty much, here's what you're supposed to know kinds of things, not a lot of some independent thinking, and we did a lot of writing, which was a good challenge for me. But it wasn't the kind of stuff that I eventually got to in my doctoral program before I really developed the critical thinking skills and the stuff that I needed to really sort through stuff and make my own decisions,
right,
based on, you know, what I was reading and learning,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily trusting what I was being told.
When do you and Tim get married?
We got married the August we graduated. We graduated in June of 1967 from our respective colleges, and we were married that August.
Okay. Now, Tim, of course, a college graduate, so that sort of deferment is no longer going to be there.
Right.
Young man, in good shape. You get married, you know that the draft is looming out there,
yep,
for a recent college graduate, and you're newly married. what kind of influence does this looming draft have on a young couple recently married?
Well, I mean, we knew it going in. When we actually, I'm trying to think, if he took the job at Bowdoin, and because it was all through senior year, or we got engaged in like March of that year, and so, and we'd been, you know, talking about it, but we officially got engaged, I think it was like in March, and so he was looking for jobs starting in probably January, and he looked at potentially going on to graduate school. He looked at, he probably told you all this because I don't need to go through that, but so we were talking about all that, but not really knowing. In fact, I was offered a job teaching in Brunswick, which was where we hoped we were going to be living, and I ended up turning it down because I, at that point, and because I had to make a decision like in June, and we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know how long we would be there. We didn't know what was going to happen. So we ended up getting almost a full year there. Tim went into the service the following May, but we really didn't know. I think we knew by the time we got married that we were probably going to get at least some time. But I can't really remember, and I don't think I have a diary from that point. I didn't bring that one out, so I didn't go back and read that far back. So I can't really remember what the time sequence was. I know that as we were going through all of that, we knew we weren't. That chances were pretty good he was going to end up going into the service at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So you just live with that. I mean, that's we started paying a whole lot of attention. Like I say, we voted for Richard Nixon because he promised he was going to get us the hell out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And he promised it again 4 years later. That time I didn't vote for him. But, so I don't know. That's, I guess, the best I can do.
Mm-hmm. And as I recall from the conversations that I had with Tim, I mean, this was he was faced with, I think, essentially the issue: wait and be drafted into the Army, wind up as a grunt pounding the ground, or look into going in as an officer. And of course, Tim, that's the way that Tim chose to go, was for OCS. Do you remember being involved in that discussion or
that
decision?
Oh yeah, we talked about all that stuff too.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was very interesting. And again, a lot of our logic was, you put it off as long as you can, and maybe we'll get the hell out of there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was. I can remember those conversations. You know, all right. So if you go, you have to go through the training. OCS takes another 6 months. You know, so maybe. And you know, if we dragged it out a couple more years, we would have made it. But it didn't quite work that way. But at least it gave us more time, and it gave us, it gave Tim a lot more. You heard him talk about his training, and I think he was a whole lot more ready to handle what he had to handle than he would have been had he gone in right out of college. I mean, it gave him really another almost 2 years before he went to Vietnam, so he was like 24. And maturity matters and stuff like that, I think.
Absolutely.
I would say it.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, you make the decision for OCS, knowing that or hoping that it will continue to buy time, as well as the other benefits of learning, of becoming an officer, of maturing, and all of these things that are very, very important as well.
Well, that's hindsight. I don't know how much of that we anticipated, but in hindsight, it certainly worked that way.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. What is it like for you to send your husband off to the big green machine, to the Army, to get chewed up by the Army to prepare him to go to a very unpopular war? What was that time like for you?
It was very much a day at a time kind of thing. I can still close my eyes and see the day he was sworn in Portland, Maine. We went down and he was officially sworn in, and I think he got on the bus right from there and left for basic training in New Jersey. And I finished out the school year that year, and then packed everything up. And I think that's kind of what kept me going, is because I knew I wouldn't be able to see him at the beginning of basic training anyway. So, all right, he's gone. And so by the time I finished the school year, he went in late May, I think it was. So I had like another 3 or 4 weeks of school. I finished up the year, packed up our little apartment, stored a bunch of stuff, boxes with his parents. I think they kept some of that. We didn't have a lot of stuff at that point. My mom still had a lot of our wedding presents at my house in Vermont, and we left a few boxes with, and then I had a carload of stuff that I took with me. And I moved to New Jersey where my grandparents lived, and I spent that summer living with them. And as soon as Tim had visiting privileges, which weren't that far in, I mean, I was a good motivator. He was one of the first in every class all the way through to get visiting privileges, because when he did, I could come visit. And actually, I can't remember exactly when, but the last 2 or 3 weeks in basic training, he actually got weekend passes. So I'd go down on Saturday morning, pick him up. We'd have until Sunday at 3 or something like that to get him back. So we'd have like 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed with my grandparents in Hohokus, New Jersey, which is about a two-hour drive. Do you know New Jersey at all?
No, I don't.
Okay, you've never driven the Jersey Turnpike?
No, ma'am.
Okay, you haven't lived yet. But it is and was, it still is, one of the most congested highways in the country. And on Sunday night, coming back from Fort Nix, New Jersey, to drive back up to my grandparents in Hohokus, was like, it was unbelievable. Everybody was coming back from the Jersey Shore. So the traffic was like, I would tell Tim, it was like 60 miles an hour, bumper to bumper. And but again, it was a confidence builder. I learned to drive in all kinds of amazing situations for a girl who'd grown up driving on the rural roads of northern Vermont between Boston and that experience. I got a lot of confidence in handling the car. And so that's what we did. And I found a part-time job working at Alan Harry's Diner in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Al and Harry were Holocaust survivors, and they had the tattooed numbers on their arms and everything. They didn't talk a lot about it, but enough so that I learned more from some of the other people who came in, that it was a newsstand lunch counter kind of place, and I worked behind the lunch counter, and it was just, again, you know, one of those experiences that you really get your eyes opened up. And so ever since then, I've been very tuned into the whole Holocaust tragedy, I don't know how you would describe that, but and all the work that's going on today to kind of capture those memories, because, I mean, that's a population, along with our World War II veterans, that's rapidly disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it needs to not ever be forgotten. I mean, that's pretty horrible. Think we let happen in this world. But anyway, so that was what I was doing during the June, the last half of June, July, and August of 1965. And because he did both AIT and basic at Fort Dix, so we were there for, I think it was 16 weeks. I think it was 8 weeks each.
Now, recently married, husband leaves to be the Army, and you've got this train, like you say, it's, you know, 3-4 months of training. Now, you mentioned that your time at Simmons there in Boston was a time in which you kind of learned to assert yourself, but you became confident, more and more confident in who you were and your abilities to think and perform. It seems to me that this is another example of this, where maybe it's not something you anticipated, it wasn't where you expected life to go, but you're kind of thrown in the deep end here as far as a new marriage, husband leaves almost immediately, and you're left to do all of these things, packing up the house, finding a job, going down to Fort Dix to pick him up, and driving back. All these little things seem like more and more challenges for a young woman. How did you embrace this? How did you adapt to this?
Well, I don't know. There were times I probably, looking back on it, would say I'm not quite sure, because I always saw myself as being a little bit shy, a little bit hesitant kind of person. I guess I really wasn't, and I wanted to see Tim, and I wanted to spend as much time with him as I could, and so those were the things you had to do in order to do that. Now, I could have, in fact, I was encouraged to just go back home and wait, but that wasn't me, and I, during the, like, about, and Tim knows this, I mean, I was a very different person when we got out of the Army than I was when we went in terms of what I wanted to do. I discovered I loved to work. I mean, I wanted to work just so that, and, you know, until I had a family, then I was going to be a mom. And no, that didn't quite cut it. I discovered I loved to work. And so I definitely became more of a career person eventually. And so, I don't know. I mean, I've always said that the Army, for me, was my 4 years of growing up, or 3 years, 3.5 years, whatever it was. And I just learned that I could do all this stuff. And so once you've done it, it's, kind of just, you know, you do it because you're going to do it, and then after that, it's not hard anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right. Basic AIT finished in the late summer of 1968. Now, Tim goes to OCS, and I believe this was at Fort Benning, Georgia,
right,
as I recall. And essentially, you are. You're attached to Tim. You're moving where the Army tells Tim to go.
They're telling him to go. They're certainly not telling me to go.
Exactly. Well, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, here you are, a young woman with growing confidence in her abilities and what she sees and what she knows, and because you have married this individual and the Army tells this individual what to do, then you are going along with him.
Right.
Does that bother you at all? That you're essentially moving along at the Army's
wings? No, it didn't bother me. And I, in fact, there have been times, if I were a young woman coming facing this today, I would have enlisted too. I mean, you know, that it's like, okay. But that really wasn't an option.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really realize that I would have, you know, probably done reasonably well in the military until I'd actually seen it up close in person a little bit later on. But no, that was just, we kind of made that decision that that's what we were going to do, and we had 2 weeks in between the end of AIT and the start of OCS, and so we had a 2 week leave, and we, you know, went and visited all the family, and again, everybody encouraged, you know, if they need to come home, that's fine, but we got to Fort Benning or to Columbus, and found a small apartment not too far from the base, and I. You know, it was a furnished apartment, so we didn't need a lot of stuff. We had enough stuff with us to keep going, and I signed up to substitute teach. And there were several other wives there from Tim's group, and they brought us together fairly quickly. So it was a small group. It was like six of us at the beginning. A lot more came back the second half. After Christmas, a lot more came. Not a lot more, but because there weren't that many married guys, but of the guys that were married, we probably, by the time we got after the Christmas break and came back in January, there probably were close to a dozen wives that were there. All kind of in similar situations, too.
Tell me about this group. That you said that you were brought together. Now, of course, the Army at this time encourages some measure of this sort of thing. Tell me about the dynamic among those of you who were involved in this group. What sort of things did you do? What were the relationships like?
The first group, I really didn't have a lot in common with, as I recall, any of them. I did become good friends with a couple of the wives that came back after Chris, and I'll, it was the officers' wives that were head of the company that were training Tim. And I can't remember the lady's name who actually brought us together. They were like, there was the captain's wife and then I think two lieutenant wives that were, it was, I can't remember the hierarchy of the training group that oversaw the OC, you know, Tim's company, whatever it was called. So they brought us together, I think within like the first month, and we had a tea or something like that. So they got us together. We formed a little group. Because there were certain things we were expected to do, not so much early on, but later on with the, they have a dance, they, you know, the rigmaroles of the military, that we were being taught how to be good military wives was what the goal was of officer wives. So that was kind of what, and it wasn't as much the first half, because there was a lot of restrictions during the first 3 months. And then after that, it began to open up a little bit more. And like I say, a lot of, we had a Christmas break right in the middle, 2 week break, and everybody got leave during that time. And a lot of guys brought their wives back, or a lot more did. And at two of Tim became friends with a group of people that were, some of whom we're still friends with to this day, in OCS. And I was kind of like the baggage handler, for lack of a better word. They were very, very fussy about uniforms and shoe polish and a lot of dumb things like that. But that's, I guess, was the, maybe the military is still that way. I spit and polish, I guess. Discipline. So anyway, I would get their laundry every week, and I did this for Tim and I think three of his good friends that began to became very good friends. And so I would get their uniforms, take them to the laundry that we all agreed did a good job. I'd get them back, and I'd take off all the tags, because they had rules about you couldn't, if you had a tag left on any of your stuff, you were in big trouble, couple demerits, whatever. And I would get them all ready, and then I would take them back out the next time I could go. Right from the beginning, I could see Tim for like an hour on Wednesday night or something like that. And again, Tim started getting leave, or a few hours. It was the first time. It was like, I think we had 3 hours where he could leave the area, and eventually he was getting an overnight on Saturday nights or that kind of thing fairly quickly, actually. I mean, probably seemed awfully long to me at the time, but wasn't. So anyway, I would bring, the next time I would go out to see them, I would bring all the stuff, and we would trade, and I'd get a new load of dirty fatigues, and they so I became that, I did that, and it gave me something to do, and I felt like I was helping a little way. I'd polish shoes, I'd do whatever needed doing. And those guys, let's see, Jay, Steve, there were four of them. There were four guys that I did their stuff, in addition to Tim, I think, three or four. And two of them were married, and they brought their wives back, and then there was another guy that we got to know. So by the time they came back, there was a larger group of wives that came back. At that group, I made friends with several of them that were, and to this day, interestingly enough, one of them is still married to the same person. Two of them are not. No, that Wally was later. Steve is not. Though we still see Steve and his new wife. They're the ones we went to Hawaii with last year. And so we've kept track of, initially we kept track of, touch with several of them, and those have faded over the years, so we now kind of keep in touch with about, from OCS, I think there's still two, and then there's a couple from later in the Army that we keep in touch with.
Now, you also mentioned that you were substitute teaching there in Columbus. I wonder if you can tell me what was the environment like there in Columbus? Now, obviously, this is going to be
more. They were under a very recent court order to desegregate.
Tell me about
this. And they were not sure that this little white girl from the north, who wasn't all that big and whatever, and brand new, relatively not totally inexperienced at that point. I had taught most of the year before, but not real experience, was going to be able to help out very much. But I did get in to several. I mean, I did develop relationships with a couple of schools, and I did work enough to kind of help keep us out of total poverty, because the Army didn't pay all that well. And I did a few times on the base, because the base had schools on base, which was very interesting. And then I did in Columbus. I never did, because Columbus is right on the line there with what's the state next door? Georgia, and then did Arkansas? I don't know. But anyway, we were right on the line, the river, and I applied for jobs over on the other side of the river, but I never did get any calls over there. But I did eventually get, so I substituted in grades K through 8 often, and not a lot. I mean, it was, you know, maybe once, sometimes twice a week. And it didn't pay all that great. It was like $20 a day, or I'm not even sure it was that much. But it was enough to kind of, given what cost of living was then, enough to help me, and it kept me busy. And it was fascinating because the desegregation was brand new to everybody. And I think that it was either the first or the second year, and I almost think it was the first. They wouldn't hire me because, I mean, obviously I wasn't going to be there that long. I couldn't lie and say, we're based here. But it was a great experience, I mean, because it really exposed me to all grades. Again, I grew up in Vermont. We had two African Americans in my high school. One of whom came for 1 year from Texas as a dorm student, and convinced his father, fortunately for him, at the end of the year that really wasn't a good place for him. I think it was one of those where they sent him there to get him out of trouble. Tex was a great guy. I loved him. He was super. But he wasn't real happy in Lindsay, Vermont, where there were absolutely no African American girls and only one other. And Danny, who was a year ahead of me, was a potato farmer. Son of a potato farmer who had settled. He was initially a migrant family, and they had settled in the area north of us that had potato farms, and we're staying there year round. And Danny was a great athlete. He was very popular. But again, that's it. Those were the only African Americans I'd ever seen until I went to college. It was a very good experience for me. And since I've been in the years I've been in education, that's been a very big issue everywhere I've ever been. So the desegregation of schools here in Delaware was, I was here when they finally lifted the deseg order. I was part of the case that they brought to say, we've done what we needed to do. And we were under court order here for something like 15, 18 years as part of the original Brown versus the Board of Education case. And that was good for me. I mean, those experiences, I mean, that's what I mean. All of these experiences really just kept broadening us. I guess that's what life does. You know, it's what it's supposed to do anyway. And it certainly did. I mean, if I'd stayed in New England, and I would never have had those kind of opportunities. Because even today, Vermont's pretty white.
Sure. Well, I wonder if, again, young woman, substitute teacher, not a lot of experience, and thrown kind of in the midst of the desegregation issue, if not battle or even conflict. What sort of things come to your mind when you think about the actual desegregation? I'm talking about the attitudes of individuals, the attitudes of other teachers, of students, of administrators, of the general community. How did this play out from what you saw there in Columbus?
Because I never really got into to the point in any school that where I really became part of the teacher group.
Mm-hmm.
I was always well treated. I was always, the principals were always, here, but most of the time it was, here's your classroom, and hope to God that the teacher that was out sick or whatever had left you a lesson plan. And
mm-hmm.
So the first thing I learned was that you always have to come with a bag of tricks, and I developed some things to do when the teacher hadn't left the lesson plan, which was more often than not. And I learned to get the kids to help me too. For the most part, they there's always kids that are willing to tell you what they're doing, making sure you don't do the stuff they don't want to do, but that kind of thing. And so from that perspective, from the kids, I don't ever remember there being a lot of problem. But again, I was elementary school. I only did like 7th and 8th grade a couple of times. So the older kids, the middle school kind of age kids, would have been where you might have seen more of that, but I don't recall any incidences where that was. It was more kind of the general talk around, the community kind of feeling that it was being forced into this kind of thing. You picked up some of that from the newspapers, from general conversations. But the military at that point was, pretty desegregated. So,
sure.
And that was very much a military town. What it existed for, or that I'm sure there were other things there, but you very definitely felt like you were in a military community.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a lot of tolerance for stuff you might have seen in smaller towns elsewhere.
Sure.
Or even bigger ones.
Well, and I think that makes a lot of sense, and it's one of the things that people don't.
But I really can't recall any. other than being told that they didn't think I could handle it because I didn't have that kind of experience. But that was when I applied for a full-time job in whatever the town was across the river. That was an excuse for not considering me. And that was fine. It turned out to work out just as well, and I actually, I did. I gained a lot by just having the exposure to all the different grades. Something you don't always get when you're learning to be an educator.
Right. Well, let me, or have you take me from Fort Benning OCS to the next step. I guess this is going to be Armor Basic School, I would assume.
Yes.
And this would have been in Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Right.
All right. So take me from Fort Benning to Fort Knox.
All right. Well, that was actually our first official assignment where I was welcomed. No, it wasn't. Because actually, he got orders for both at the same time. We got the orders to go to the opposite, the Armor Basic thing. And that was, I think, just 6 weeks, maybe eight, but it wasn't very long. And so that was a temporary assignment again, too. And then we were permanently assigned then to Fort Lewis in Washington. And that was our first official assignment where we could get our stuff shipped and that. So at that point, I was able to set up to get our stuff shipped from both Vermont and Massachusetts, as well as we also shipped some of our stuff that we had been carrying around with us in the car, because by then we'd accumulated a little more stuff.
Right.
So that was nice. They actually packed it up and worked with our families and the other two pieces and got that and shipped it all out there. So that was a good thing. I don't think we had a break between OCS and Armor. I think we had to go right there. Because that was in Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
So, but maybe we must have had travel time. But I don't know. I don't remember that we had time to go up to visit. I think we must have. We must have had time to go visit family at that point. So maybe we got another two-week leave, did the family thing again, and then headed to Fort Knox, where we again rented a small furnished apartment off the base. Tim had about a half-hour drive, and there were about four or five of us that all came from Tim's OCS class. So it was kind of like the same group of women that I'd gotten to be friends with. We were all assigned there for Tim was Armor, there was a finance school there. There were several schools there, so they were there for different reasons. So we had this group of people that we knew, and they all rented apartments in the same place, so we were all kind of neighbors for that short period of time. And Tim actually got to come home every night, which was great. So we lived a little bit more of a normal life for those 8 weeks. The only tough thing that happened during that time is my grandmother died, the grandmother I had been living with the summer before. We did have a leave before that because I had just seen her. We stopped to see her I was very close to my grandparents, and we had stopped to see them on our way to Fort Knox. So she died very suddenly of a heart attack. And so I had to fly back to New Jersey for her funeral. That was very, very traumatic for me. But Tim was he didn't come. I think they said he really wasn't entitled to come. That wasn't a close enough, I can't remember. But he didn't anyway. And so I spent three or four days with my family there and then came back. And I never saw my grandfather again after that. He died about 11 months later, so when we were out west. That was kind of like an end of an era for me. I was kind of their favorite granddaughter, and so it was pretty hard. But anyway, that happened, and at least I was close enough so I could get back there. And we finished up at Fort Knox. And I didn't work. I didn't do it. I just kind of puttered around there because it wasn't long enough to really do anything. It was
sure.
April, May, so it was like the end of the school year. And we had a little bit of raise in pay once he became commissioned, so we didn't have quite the tight. And then we had, I think we had 10 days maybe. Enough time, we drove out to Fort Lewis, and we had, that was our, again, talk about opportunities. That was our first Western trip, and we stopped at a couple of places. My parents had visited not Yellowstone, but Grand Teton,
mm-hmm.
and had always raved about how beautiful Grand Teton was. So I had made a reservation at the Teton cabins near the lodge. I don't know if you've ever been to the Grand Tetons. If you haven't, that's yeah, need to put that on your list. Yellowstone, right near Yellowstone. And so we went out and we went through the Grand Teton, stayed in a little lodge cabin there for like two nights and did a little hiking and walking around, and then went on up through Yellowstone and then on into Washington. Across from there. And then arrived at Fort Lewis, and Tim had to report fairly quickly. We'd use most of the time to travel, and we couldn't get into base housing right away, so we spent, I think, about maybe 10 days in this kind of weird old building. Like, it was some kind of hotel, motel for, you know, transferring families. We had this crazy room way up in the, on the top floor of it. Initially, they eventually moved us down a little bit, but, and we had rain for the first 3 days we were there, and everybody kept asking me if I'd seen Mount Rainier yet, and I kept saying, no, no. And then one day I looked out the window, and the sun was shining, and so I raced outside and had my first encounter with Mount Rainier, which was is still my absolute favorite mountain in the whole world. And and a little bit later, we got assigned to base housing, so things settled down. I applied for jobs, got a job, and
teaching again, I assume. I assume this is another teaching position.
I had my own fifth grade classroom for a whole. I taught that grade for class for 2 years.
What was it like after moving to New Jersey, then down to Georgia, then into Kentucky very briefly? Now you're up in Washington State.
Right.
What was it like for you to finally settle in?
We were able to actually have a house, and we lucked out. We got a. Nobody could understand why we got it. We got a three-bedroom ed unit, and we don't know if it's just because Tim kept nagging the guy or what, because normally those only went to people with kids, and we didn't have any kids, so I don't know what, but anyway, we lucked out, so we had a guest room and everything. They were townhouses on the base housing, and so we got to fix it up. We hadn't been there too long when we finally got our first dog and a little puppy, and so we had our puppy to play with. Tim had some, because he was the low man on the totem pole, he got a lot of not-so-great assignments, but he was home most nights, and he had not every weekend, but a lot of, usually some time off on every weekend, and sometimes the whole weekend. So we got to start exploring the area, and before it got too cold, we had opportunities. We got up to Mount Rainier at least twice that year, and that's when we really discovered how much we loved the hiking and the outdoor stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And started developing some of those kinds of. I did my first hike in sneakers, and the first thing we bought with the next paycheck were hiking boots.
Became a priority pretty quickly.
Yeah, you figured that one out. And I don't know. That was life kind of settled in there. We had a few friends that came through that we knew before. We met, you know, the people who lived around us. People on the base were very friendly. And Tim wasn't there long enough to get too hung up. I mean, we lived on base from, let's see, we would have gotten there in, I think it was late June. So, and we moved out before Christmas following that year. So we weren't there more than, 6 months that we actually lived on base.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time, like I say, it was not a bad experience, other than we knew the orders were going to be coming before long and all that stuff. But, you know, you take it day at a time. So I had the summer to kind of get organized and the house set up and meet the neighbors, and then I started working in late August, I guess it was. I went back to work, and that was because it was the first time I had a class where I had to do all the prep work. I mean, since Maine, I had done that in Maine too, but so was a lot of work that first year, but it was fun. I had a great group of kids, several of whom were military kids, but many whom were not, and it worked out well.
Well, let me ask you this, Martha. I recall from my conversations with Tim that his time there at Fort Lewis was not the best in terms of career, the things he saw
with
the Army. It was not an incredibly positive time for him, and you're seeing him a lot more than you used to. I mean, to some degree, this is kind of like an 8-to-5 job with some exceptions. What kind of, how did Tim manifest, or did it manifest itself, his displeasure with what he was experiencing in the Army and his new role there?
Well, this is the time when he had the pineal cyst that I think he talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And that really put a damper on. I'd forgotten all about that, but that happened in August. And and we hadn't been there that long at that point, but he was in a lot of pain, and then it laid him up for a good couple of weeks after he had the surgery. And then today they probably would have, would have been an outpatient thing that would have been done, and it probably would be a whole lot easier. But at that point, he spent like, I think, 4 days in the hospital, and I think he described to you what the ward was like. And there were a lot of wounded veterans there. So, and he spent a lot more time there than I did. I would minimize my time there because I have this fainting thing in hospitals, and so even then every time I would go in there, the smells would just make me feel like it. But I went every day. And so that was a negative. And then he got stuck at home for 2 weeks, and we had these friends that we had known from OCS. Well, we knew the guy, and he had gotten married to a young, I think she was Korean. I'm not sure, I think, but she was Asian. And from Asia, I mean, she spoke English, but not real fluently. So, I mean, she was definitely a first-generation person. And he treated her like crap. And it drove, I couldn't stand to be around him. I mean, he would order around. And they hadn't been married that long. I mean, it's like, I guess that's what, I can't remember the guy. I can see his face, I can't remember his name. And they lived with us for like 2 weeks while they were waiting for base housing. And that turned out to be, and that was part of the time that Tim was at home. And that was just not a really, really good thing. So that probably was part of that. That was not a fun time. But he got over that. He got back to work. But the job itself was very boring. And I think that, and I don't think he felt like it was a particularly useful time in what he was doing. And I also think the not knowing when the ball was going to drop was the other part of it that made it pretty difficult for him.
Right.
He was low man on the totem pole. I mean, he was the newbie lieutenant who hadn't been in combat yet, so it was, but he wasn't, I mean, in terms of how we were fine. I mean, we just kept busy. We'd take advantage whenever we could get a break to go explore something, or, there was a lot of stuff to do. We were in a part of the world we'd never been in before, and so we had Seattle, we had Tacoma, we had Mount Rainier, and the ocean. So, my first chance to see the Pacific Ocean.
Let me ask you this, just one last question, I think, fit for today's session, Martha. Now, you and Tim have been looking at the specter of Vietnam for quite a while.
Yeah.
You know this.
I'd say, you could clearly say from at least 1966 on, it was part of, I can't remember back. I'd have to go back and look at my diaries to see if we talked about it much the first year we met. But certainly by the time we were juniors in college, it was definitely on the horizon.
Right. And there you are, working together, New Jersey, Alabama, Kentucky. Now you're on the West Coast. throughout the year, say from 66, when you become cognizant of this as something that could possibly impact your life, Tim's life. And now we're looking at 1969 into 1970, and even later, of course, where Tim deploys. How aware are you of what's taking place in Vietnam, and what are you seeing on the home front, and how does that affect your attitude toward all of this? It's about three questions
seeing,
after Richard there.
Yeah, what we were seeing was definitely this war wasn't going to get over quickly. I mean, you were certainly seeing a lot of, I mean, the protests were starting to gear up. You were starting to see a lot of pushback in Congress and nationally in terms of why are we still here and whatever. But there was no way this was going to go away quickly. I'm trying to think when Cambodia first came onto the scene, but I know, it didn't happen until, March or April, because Tim was there when the actual invasion occurred, but you started to hear more and more about that. I don't know, it's kind of like an inevitability that, Tim was going to go. I mean, that, and I don't think he was that uncomfortable with the idea anymore, so I tried not to be.
Right.
It's, I had a lot of faith that he would do well. I mean, I think even then I probably realized how much of his luck. But I don't know. I don't really know what to tell. We were very aware of it. Neither one of us, and even to this day, I don't think that would be different. We were not the kind that were going to turn tail and run to Canada. Though I have a lot of respect for people who did that. I certainly understand why they did that. But I don't think even had we come along 4 years later when that was clearly something that a lot of folks were doing, I don't think we would have ever done that. I just don't think that's, we weren't raised that way, and I don't think we would have been able to, the right or wrong stuff probably would have won out, our country right or wrong kind of thing. So I don't know. I'm not sure I'm really answering your question, but it...
No, that's fine. It's fine. Well, let's go ahead and take a break there for today, then.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Martha Brooks. Today is 17 January 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Dr. Brooks is joining me by telephone from her home in Newark, Delaware. Martha, last time we left off, we had you about ready to ship Tim off to jungle training down in Panama. Can you pick up the story there for me?
Okay, he left for, we had moved off base out into our apartment, which was pretty near my school where I taught, and about maybe 25 minutes from the base, in a little town called Spanaway, Washington, which was just outside of Tacoma. And we had he had a couple days leave before he actually left for Panama, so he spent a lot of time with our puppy and did a lot of house cleaning for me before he left. And then I think was really, based on what I just read, he was really ready to go. He wanted to kind of get it started. It was sort of that kind of let's just get going kind of thinking. And
right.
So he left on the 15th of January. And I kind of got a 3-week taste of what life was going to be like. Figured out how to try to keep as busy as I could. And the 3 weeks went by pretty fast because I knew I still had the whole month of, he was going to be on leave for most of that time, if not all of it, before he left. So I unfortunately was working during all that time. And I kept right on working. Teachers don't get to take vacation in the middle of the winter.
Right. Now, were you able to correspond with Tim at all during these 3 weeks when he was in jungle training?
No, I don't think we had letters. I don't think, because it was just, he really didn't have an address. I'm just checking to see if I, because I always talked about writing a letter at the end of my day. I don't think I did.
I might also mention for someone who may be listening to this in the future that you do have a copy of your diary that you kept
right.
at this time. And
I
assume that you're going to be referring back to it like occasionally as we go through this, perhaps.
But no, it doesn't look like I wrote letters.
Mm-hmm.
I did get a postcard from him, it mentions here, when he was in South Carolina on his way to Panama. And I probably got a couple more postcards from Panama, but that would have been about it. I think we knew that there wasn't going to be much. He was basically in training that entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Once he got there, the travel down and back, of course, took a couple days each way. But it was, I think, a fairly structured course. That's the way he's always described it. And I don't think he had any free time.
Right. So you say this 3 weeks was kind of like a test run for what
right.
you were going to come up against when he's deployed to Vietnam. What did you find out about yourself as a result of this three-week test run?
That the days went a lot faster when I kept really busy. Like, the school days actually would go pretty fast because I was busy all day. And I had joined a health spa, and I started regularly going to that two, three times a week. And after school, so that, again, kept me busy. I had the dog, and I didn't start... I signed up to take her to puppy training school, though I didn't start that until March when he actually left for Vietnam. I looked for stuff like that would kind of keep me busy. And I think even then I realized that weekends were the hardest because I had too much time on my hands.
Right. Now, Tim's gone for 3 weeks and
right.
comes back, and you mentioned that he had a considerable leave before he deployed to Vietnam.
He had 5 weeks before, and I'm not sure he was on leave that entire time, but I think he was a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
Why, I don't know, because it doesn't make much sense to me why they would let people sit around and contemplate too much. But
right. What did you do during those 5 weeks, do you remember?
Well, like I say, I was teaching, so I think we took I took a couple of, quote, sick days toward the end, and we took a long weekend and went down on the Oregon coast for a couple of days. And again, keep in mind, this is February, not exactly, I don't know if you know the Northwest at all, but it rains all winter.
Right.
And so that's the kind of weather we were getting. But we did do that. And then his parents came out to visit during that time and spent several days with us. Tim described that, I think he probably told you, that his mother, at least, was convinced she'd never see him again. I think his dad was a little more optimistic. But they never let on. I mean, they were very upbeat the entire time they were here, and, you know, we're visiting, and, you know, they just... But that was... his mom, by that time, had developed fairly significant diabetes, and was very fragile diabetic. I mean, she was on insulin. So they had to be very careful. If she bumped her leg, it would, you know, open up into a sore and bleed and not heal and all that kind of stuff. So they were very, very careful what they did and didn't do. So their coming out was actually a fairly big deal. And so that was, I'm trying to think if there was anything else. We visited a friend that we knew from OCS, who lived in Portland, Oregon, and her husband had already been deployed. He was already over there, so we stopped to see her, and hadn't had her baby yet. Oh no, she had her baby. I just was looking. I just found the date when we went down there, and she had her baby. So we got to meet the baby. That was a big debate among the wives whether they should have a baby before their husbands went to Vietnam, or, you know, be pregnant. And Tim was very adamant that that was not going to be. If he was going to have a child, he was going to be home to raise it. We would just wait.
Is that right?
That was something that was very. Most of the friends that we made in OCS either had babies or were pregnant by the time their husbands were deployed. And in most cases, they ended up going to Vietnam, so in one capacity or another. Not all of them, but most of them did.
you mentioned that Tim was adamant that that would not be the case
right.
for you guys. What was your position on this?
I mean, I was kind of torn, but I absolutely understood that, you know, being pregnant, that would have meant, well, two things. I probably would have had to go back east, back home.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do that. I don't know why. I was just pretty stubborn about being independent, and I didn't want to go back and kind of be a burden, which I wouldn't have been a burden. My parents never would have looked at me that way, but I would have.
Mm-hmm.
I was fairly independent, had been brought up to be fairly independent, and by that time I was becoming even more independent. So that wasn't enough. So from that perspective, I didn't want it. But on the other hand, you can't help but think, well, I would at least have something. If something happened to Tim, I would at least have his child. And so it was a back and forth.
Yeah, I would imagine. So plus you have a career that you're beginning here. You're
right. And I also was really enjoying my teaching.
And staying busy, which would accompany, of course, having a job. And you mentioned that staying busy was very important for you as well.
Yes.
Hmm.
Well, plus it was also gave us a little bit more financial security.
Well, yes, there's a variety of
issues. Yeah, a lot of reasons why that was. They didn't pay second lieutenants all that well.
Right.
Of course, they didn't pay teachers all that well either. But between the two of us, we got by.
All right, now, Tim leaves, I believe it's in March
right.
of 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that moment, that leaving? Did he leave from Fort Lewis, I would assume?
No, actually, he flew out of SeaTac.
Okay.
I had to drive him to the airport. I have the day. It was Sunday, March 8th, and I drove him. We had to get up, according to my notes, at 5:30 in the morning, so he must have had a very early morning flight. And he flew from there to Travis Air Force Base, and that's where he actually, from there is where he flew to Vietnam. But I still think, I mean, almost all those flights were commercial airlines that they used to transport back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think they were military flights, but they were regular airliners.
Right.
They weren't being carried on the big C-10s or whatever those big things are. So it was brutal. I mean, it was. I can still close my eyes and see him walking down the tunnel onto the airplane, and it, you know, it's like, is this? And knowing that I was looking at 330 something days before I would see him again. Well, actually, though, R&R became very important to me very quickly, so I counted
right.
to that far and didn't. And I think it was very, very hard for Tim. It was very hard when we left the house, because that was, you know, he had to say goodbye to his dog, and Tim has always been an animal person, and he was very attached to this puppy we had, who was, by that point, she's 7 or 8 months old, so she's getting pretty big. And you can't explain to the dog, you know, that you're going to be gone. Plant had to learn that the hard way. That was our dog's name, and it was, that was really hard, because she would be looking for him every night to come home, and he didn't. And after a while, she, you know, stopped doing that. But it was really, that was tough. And he had a very hard time saying goodbye to her. And then, so that was traumatic. And then when we got to the airport, and he finally just said, I have to go. I can't deal with this anymore. So we had a big hug, and he turned and walked down onto the plane, and that was it. I drove home.
Now, when you go home, obviously you're headed back to what is essentially an empty house.
Right.
When does it set in that this is
the
real
I think
deal?
I mean, in some ways it's the anticipation of it that is far worse than the reality. I mean, I knew this was, we knew it was coming for so long, and now it was here. So that what that meant was, I could start marking the days off the calendar, and that's really clear. I actually have the calendar where a line went through every single day.
Is that right?
Apparently, all the guys in Vietnam had them too. That was something we would joke about after he got back, that marking off the days on the calendar.
Right.
So I don't know. It was a Sunday, which was normally a day when I had to do a lot of, you know, laundry and stuff anyway. So I just came home and did all of that stuff and just tried to keep. I had friends. My friends invited me over for dinner that night, and I took the dog and we went over and had dinner, and so I got through that. And I don't think I slept very well for several nights, but you know, you just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just did. You didn't have any choice. So.
It's one thing to be separated from your husband. It's another thing for your husband to be going into a combat zone. I mean, he is a young officer, junior officer, who's in armor, and armor may or may not be more safe than a ground infantry unit, but nonetheless, he's going in harm's way here. I mean, in addition to the 1 year where you know you're not going to see your husband,
right?
What kind of additional issues did it bring up that he was going into a combat zone?
Well, it's really funny because I knew for the first probably week he would not be in combat, so I said, okay, I don't have to worry about him this week. You know, flying, of course, plane could have crashed, all kinds of things could have, but, you know, I did, and I'm like, all right. And then by the time I heard what his assignment was and where he was and all of that kind of stuff, we were almost into week two. And so then the being on my own I'd gotten kind of past the hurdle of, yes, it's really here now, and into that. So, and there were times when I would worry like crazy, and then there were other times when I just didn't think about it. I was read through this, not for this, but the other day when I was looking at it, and as the Cambodian thing started to really appear, and I knew where Tim was located, and I knew, and actually they mentioned his the 11th Armored Cav several times in the newspaper reports as going in and being part of the thing, and I didn't know until much later that his company, I guess it was one of the ones that was kind of being stayed on the border for quite a while. He did eventually go in, but he wasn't one of the first waves that went in. He was the backup. His company was the backup company to the group that went in initially. But I didn't know that. All I knew was in the paper that it said the 11th Armored Cav was one of the four front groups that went in, and it was mentioned at least twice in the paper by name. That was scary. Not knowing what was happening, and again at the same time, with all of that, you were seeing all the stuff in this country going on that said, "Oh no, wait a minute, we don't want this stuff happening." So it was like, you know, you can't ignore it. And I, like I say, I've always watched the news and had to watch the news. I had to know what was happening. And you'd get the death counts. That was in the days when they would tell you how many people had been killed, almost on a daily basis, if not on a daily basis. And I don't know. I know I coped with it, and I know there were some really bad times when I would get really depressed, and then I would go try to find people, or people would reach out to me. I think being with the kids and going to school was probably what kept me sane. You know, you just have to kind of put yourself, your own things aside, and concentrate on other people.
Sure.
So I did have a couple of kids in my class that were military kids, and I think at least one of them had a father who was deployed at that time. So, you know, that you kind of really made an effort to reach out and connect.
Right. Well, now during the day, obviously, you're busy. You've got kids to deal with. You've got your job, your career, grading papers, doing all these things.
Yeah.
But when you're home, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon until bedtime, what is that part of the day like for you?
That's where my dog saved me. I had to take care of the dog. And so I would come home, and she'd been cooped up all day, and so we would have to go and exercise and get her out there and get her. She was a very rambunctious puppy. And so there would be that. And then there would be, you know, getting her fed and getting her, giving her attention and all that kind of stuff. So that kind of really helped me. I didn't realize how important that was going to be until it, you know, it actually happened. But it really was a way to keep you from being, I wasn't alone. I had my dog. I'm sure that's the way a lot of people felt about their kids and you know, that kind of thing too. That this was some human, not human, but live thing that needed your attention and needed and she would stick to me like glue. Once she realized, I don't know if she realized, I don't know what animals go through, but Tim wasn't coming back, so she then became my best friend and was always super welcoming when I came home and would just kind of sit by me at home and slept on the bed and got away with all kinds of stuff. I think that was the biggest single thing. And then I had friends who made a real effort to let me be alone too long, to include me in activities that, you know, normally they would have included me as a couple, but I had my best friend out there went to health spa with me to the gym that we belonged to, and she, not all the time, but most of the time we went together, and she was just a super friend the whole time. Never. And then there were a lot of other people who intermittently would, the teachers at school were really very supportive. There was one other teacher there whose husband was deployed at the same time, and so they you know, kind of supported both of us. I think above and beyond what, you know, they would any young teacher, but I don't know. To me, it helped.
Right. Again, to go back to your dog, did you guys purchase the dog or acquire the dog for this very reason, so that you would have someone or something to keep you busy and keep you?
No, we always had wanted a dog, but because we were moving around so much, we moved something like 5 times in 13 months.
Right.
There was no way we were getting a dog before we settled down. So one of the first things when we got to Washington, and we knew we were going to be there for a while, or at least I was going to be there for a while, we got our puppy. We had said we would do that. We had talked about it when we first got married. We both grew up with animals, and so that was something we wanted. And so we got Plant, I think within 2 or 3 weeks of our getting our, after we moved into our apartment, we started looking right away for ads in the paper and found her. We had her really quickly after we moved to the apartment, so mm-hmm. or to the base housing. So we'd had her that whole 6 months plus. So she was about, she must have been about 8 months old by the time when Tim actually left.
You were again, a self-proclaimed news junkie.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned reading the newspaper, and you talked about the, you know, keeping up with things on television, the nightly news as it came on. Did your desire, if not compulsion, to keep up with the news and to know what's going on, did that make things easier for you in this time, or to make it more difficult?
I don't know. I guess I was always aware of the time difference between what I was reading about and what was actually happening, and then when I would hear from Tim, because his letters would tend to come in clumps,
mm-hmm.
and so I'd go maybe 6, 7, 8 days without a letter, and then all of a sudden I would get, you know, a whole panful of them. And then I would hear from his perspective what was happening or what was happening with his group of guides. And I was always pretty cognizant of that. Well, that, you know, you can't, what you hear on the news, even though they said it happened that day, I never knew enough to know exactly where Tim connected to that.
Right.
And because he'd always been very upbeat about, you know, his chances of survival, I think I had that. I mean, I had great confidence in him. I mean, he had it in himself, and I bought it. I mean, he was a very capable person, as part of what attracted me to him in the first place. So, I don't know. I certainly worried. I mean, don't get me wrong. I absolutely did worry, but I don't remember getting to the point where I couldn't handle it, at least not for more than an hour or two at a time.
Right. And how
often? And I had, like, my parents came out to visit during April. I had, you know, everybody really made an effort to. My sisters came out to visit during the summer. So everybody did things to kind of help me not be, have things I had to do to keep busy.
Right. You mentioned the letters that Tim sent to you. They typically came in kind of in bunches.
Right.
What about you? How often did you correspond with him?
Oh, I wrote every day.
Did you?
Every day. Yep, that was part of my routine. I sent a letter out every single morning, and at night, that was that and writing in my diary were my last activities of the day, and I don't think I missed more than maybe 5 or 10 days the entire year. But unfortunately,
right?
My letters didn't survive.
Hmm.
We talked about that when we were joking about it. I said, you know, we should have, in hindsight, sent my letter. He should have just sent them back, but he didn't. He'd keep them until a new bunch came, and then because they were living in the jungle,
of course,
he had no real way to keep them, and so he'd keep them until new ones came, and then he'd get rid of them. They'd disintegrate eventually, and then he would just kind of get rid of them. So we have very few of my letters. We have a few from toward the end, but
what sort of things would you guys correspond about?
A lot of day-to-day stuff. He told me quite a bit about, you know, where he was. He never went into gruesome detail. For example, when that first incident where he got the shrapnel wound, he told me about that after he was already back. He never really left the front. He was treated and he there, and then he just stayed there. But he told me about that. But again, it was like 2 weeks later by the time I heard about it. So not going to worry about that now because it's all over. And he was, in hindsight, incredibly lucky that he put the shoes on the wrong feet and he tripped. And the other same thing with the other couple of you know, places where he was hurt mildly. He never had a serious injury, and then the firefights and stuff. He didn't talk a lot. He'd talk about like the mad minutes, and he'd talk about why they did it, and then they would talk about, you know, stuff like that. But he never went into gruesome detail. A lot of the gruesome stuff, like when they found the village with all the dead people and stuff like that. That all happened after he got home. He was very careful in his letters not to. He didn't cover anything up, but he didn't give me the gruesome details.
Right.
That way.
Now, you knew basically where he was going to be operating there in Vietnam, close
right.
to Cambodia, and you get the information that the United States is going to cross the border
right.
into Cambodia. When you saw the news, when you read it in the paper, or however you came about that, did you think, other than, of course, the 11th Cav being involved in this, did you think, all right, this is a history thing here, and my husband is likely involved in this? Did anything like that cross your mind?
No. I have to say, I don't think I thought about it as being historical. I was more worried that it was an expansion of the war, which was already not going very well, and not going well at all, and was certainly becoming increasingly unpopular at home. And I think the Cambodian invasion was, I don't know, because I'm not a historian in that perspective, but it seemed at the time that was just not something that was well received. And they didn't stay there that long. But it was definitely a. But I didn't think about it as being historic. No.
Well, you bring up another good point. You talk about the unpopularity of the war, and now, granted, you are in an area that is a large number of military folks, so it would not necessarily have been, like the campus of Cal Berkeley or San Francisco or whatever.
Right.
But what was the level of activity, anti-war activity, as you saw it there in that area?
The level of anti-war activity was very much what I read in the paper and saw on TV. There was a lot of coverage of that on TV during that time frame, and so that was where I was basically seeing it. I wasn't involved. I don't remember any direct incidents around either the base or where I lived outside of Tacoma. And I wasn't in school. I did take a course in the summer, but I went to Pacific Lutheran University, and there was no unrest that was evident on the college campus there, or any of that. So it was very much what I saw on the news and read in the paper. And it was widely covered. They had increasingly as the unrest grew and the anti-war movement grew, it became almost as often on the news as we were getting reports of what was happening in Vietnam.
Right. Well, the incident at Kent State is an outgrowth of
this. Oh, yeah.
What do you remember about that?
Oh, that was just brutal. It was, first of all, unbelievable that it happened. And as it came out, it was just a horrible incident to have put either the young people that were at Kent State through, or I think the young men in the National Guard. The whole thing was just an absolute horror. And I think it kind of woke up America to the seriousness of what was going on. I don't know. That's the way it always seemed to me, is that those four young people died, and everybody kind of then began to really very seriously address how we get out of this, because we weren't going to Vietnam was one of those wars that took people a long time to realize you're never really going to win it, short of going in and dropping another atomic bomb on top of it, blowing the place up. So, and I think we always have hoped that we learned a lesson from that, but current events don't tend to tell us we really learned it all that way.
You mentioned that you were taking a class at Pacific Lutheran University. Uh-huh. What was the point in taking that?
Well, I eventually moved on and worked to get my master's degree there. But at that point, it was two reasons. One was it kept me busy, and two, you always have to be earning certification credits.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my way of doing that. I was not trained. Washington was one of those states that had a rule about you had to have a Washington history course in order to be certified as a teacher. So my certification was temporary. I think there were a couple of other things I had to have too, and I took one or two courses there. And I actually took the history course on a correspondence course and never finished it because we moved to Oregon. So I never did get my full certification in Washington. But it was a combination. It gave me something to do in the summer, kept me busy, and plus I needed the credits.
Right, right. Now, this is going to seem like maybe a silly kind of question, and perhaps it is, but I think that someone who would be listening to this would like to know, and that is, what did you find to be the most difficult aspect of your husband being away in Vietnam for nearly a year?
Hmm.
Or if there were several issues?
It probably were several. One was the, I was lonely. I mean, Tim and I, from the very beginning of our relationship, have always been each other's best friend. And so, even though I had friends I could talk to, it wasn't the same as talking to Tim. And I always describe the first 5 years of our marriage as one great big long honeymoon because we spent actually more time apart than we did together. And so it was like he wasn't there. And it was a long time until August rolled around and we had our big 5-day R&R. So I was just really, really lonely. And it was like, you know, how do you kind of keep, keeping busy works to a point, but it still doesn't take away the fact that he wasn't there. And he wasn't coming home. It wasn't a 2-week thing. It was going to be a long time thing. So I think that was probably the biggest thing, was just that, and being really on my own and not having anybody to kind of share things with and talk through things with and all of that. But.
Now, when I've interviewed wives of Vietnam veterans in the past, one of the, I guess, constant threads that I see in these interviews with these ladies is that if there is a positive thing that came out of this, it was that she would be in charge. I mean, she was dealing with mortgage, she was dealing with the bank, she was dealing with children, she was dealing with all of the things that they either typically shared, the husband and wife, or that the husband essentially took care of. Did you find that to be the case here?
Oh, absolutely. And I've often said, I mean, like I indicated last time when we were talking, that my Army years were the years I grew up. I had to do all of that, and unfortunately we didn't have any kids, so I didn't have that part of the responsibility on my own. But everything else, I mean, I handled all the bills, I handled all of that. And this was at a time, Tim had to leave me a power of attorney because at that point, women still didn't have, I didn't have my own credit cards. I didn't have, you couldn't get them. I mean, that was, you know, I keep forgetting how we have made some progress here. So, yeah, there was a lot of that. And, we didn't have a house. I mean, we rented, and so I knew what our bills were, and I handled all that. I had to take care of the car. That was one that I gladly gave back to him. But I also, then in the future, when we got to the two-car family, I kind of always was able to take care of my car and make sure it got taken care of. And of course, the dog and taking care of Tim was always the one who would exercise the dog and throw the ball for and do all that kind of stuff. And I had to do that too, so that was, yeah. I learned I could do it, and absolutely. I mean, Tim has always said the Martha he married in 1967 was not the Martha he came home to from Vietnam. In terms of that, I mean,
right.
In terms of being far more independent and I guess able, you know, I don't know what the right word is, having the confidence to, I guess, deal with all that stuff.
You mentioned the R&R that you both, or when you met in Hawaii, I guess it was August of 1970. Explain what that was like.
Oh, it was great. We stayed. Well, I flew into into Honolulu, stayed at the base. They had the kind of a little motel that they would put people up in, and Tim flew in the next day. And then we flew from Honolulu to Kauai, where we stayed. We had rented hotel room in a place called, I can't remember, it's not there anymore, it got blown away in one of the hurricanes, but it was the hotel where Blue Hawaii was filmed. I don't know if you remember any Elvis Presley history, but
one
of his famous movies was Blue Hawaii, and it's the hotel that he was, that there were scenes from that hotel. That's where we stayed. It was on the coast in Kauai. And we rented a car, and we explored the island, and we had five wonderful days of sun and togetherness, and it was great. And then, of course, we had to leave again.
That's the other
that
side.
That wasn't great.
What was that like?
Oh, that was, well, in hindsight, it was like a movie. We get to the airport. We flew back to Honolulu the night before we were leaving. And stayed in a hotel right near the airport. We go to the airport, and our two planes are parked literally back to back on the tarmac, and one's headed off to one direction, and the other one's headed off to the other direction. And we kind of like, and we literally were boarding almost at exactly the same time, and all that. So it was very. And the other good part of it was I was traveling alone, and they were looking for somebody to move into first class that was a single seat because they were a full plane, and I got to sit up in first class.
Well, there you go.
That made it a little bit easier flying home, but it was beautiful. I mean, it was it was such a wonderful vacation, and it was also, we were past the halfway point at that point because we did it in August, and in late August, so. We were hoping he would be home. I was actually hoping at that point he might make it home for Christmas, but it turned out to be January. He actually shouldn't have been home until February. He got a month early out because we got him into graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And we were already working on that at that point. That was part of the, cause that was, the Army had, or the military was letting people get early outs for school. And so it took a lot of work, but we eventually got there.
You mentioned that this is a little bit past the halfway point. Did seeing Tim in Hawaii on this R&R, once you left and came back home, did it make it more difficult or did it make it easier?
Well, actually, no, because he had a couple more months in the field after that, but we knew that at some point he would be coming back to the back. He would become the executive officer, and he would be the support lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And which he wasn't anxious to do at all. He really, he liked the action, and I understand that knowing Tim. But on the other hand, I felt a lot better when he wasn't out there
sure.
all the time. And it was only after he got home that he would tell me how often he went out there and, you know, and got himself into trouble. But it was like most of the combat time was almost over by the time, or supposedly was almost over. So that was a plus. I got home, and within, I think it's like a week or 10 days, I'm starting school again. So I'm back to being really busy. And it was, I don't know, it's just easier to count down than it is up. You know, it's like, I don't remember it being the adjustment. It was hard, obviously, because you didn't have that excitement of looking forward to the R&R that, but now I was looking forward to the end.
Right.
And so that was, so as the days went by, that became closer and closer and easier to do.
Now, having been away for all these months and you meet there in Hawaii, describe the Tim that you saw.
Well, first of all, he was absolutely gorgeous because he was lean and very fit looking. He was very tanned looking. He just looked absolutely terrific. So that was a plus. He didn't want to talk a whole lot about Vietnam. We did talk a little bit. We did see. We had one friend who was from OCS who was based there, and we did see him and his wife. I'm trying to think. I think that was from the day we came back, before right at the end, we saw Maureen and Jay. And he was the guy who came in number one in the class and got his choice of assignment, ended up in Hawaii. Shows it's good to be a high performer.
There you go.
And even though he would have been a fantastic officer, no matter where he put him. So he was a great guy. But so we saw them, and that was great to reconnect with them. And then, the two guys may have talked a little more about the war. I don't know. But Tim did not talk a whole lot about. He talked about some of his guys. It's very, for the most part, very proud of his men, and very told funny stories about them, what they liked to do, didn't like to do. That kind of stuff he would talk about, but he didn't talk a lot about combat or any of that.
Why do you think that was?
I think that he didn't want to scare me and didn't want, I don't know, because I don't know if other people would have been more forthcoming with that. That just wouldn't be what I would have expected. I mean, if I'd probed him, he might have, but I had no big need to know just how awful it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was awful enough just knowing what you read about war. I mean, it's not, war's not pretty. And I already knew that, so I didn't need to hear the gruesome details. But I don't think I really realized this until much later, is what it does to people who have to actually go through it and see it and participate in it. And when you look at the damage that does to so many people, I think Tim actually came out in pretty decent shape. And I've often thought that part of the reason for that is because he was a little bit older. He wasn't 18, 19 years old.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But for whatever reasons, he didn't talk about the gory stuff. He would talk about the people. He would talk about where they'd been. He thought parts of Vietnam were absolutely incredibly beautiful. And he was, he would complain about what was happening with where they'd been napalmed and the jungle wiped out. He was very fascinated by the jungle itself, and he thought the people were beautiful. But then, and he would talk sometimes about, they were really neat people, but you'd get into some of these areas and you couldn't even trust the kids walking towards you because they might have a rifle or a hand grenade or something. And you had to be very, very careful when you were dealing with out, when he was out, not like in Saigon, but he didn't spend much time in Saigon anyway.
Right. He's also going to be away. You're going to be separated for the holidays of 1970 and 1971. What was it like to get through the holiday season?
Well, I actually, that was the one time I flew back east. I did go home and spend Christmas with my family. I took my dog with me. I couldn't bear to be separated from it. It shows you how dependent I was. I couldn't put her. I said, I'll come, but I'm bringing my dog. And so we flew back, and I saw Tim's parents. They lived in Boston. I flew into Boston, spent a day or two with them. My parents came down and picked me up from Vermont. I went up there and spent probably close to 5 or 6 days. And then they brought me back to Boston. I spent another day and then flew back. Because we didn't know for sure when Tim was getting back. I mean, it could have been, I was hoping it would be earlier, actually, during the end of vacation. I got back home, I think, before New Year's, because there was a chance he might have gotten shipped out before then. But as it turned out, it was like January 2nd, I think he came home.
Now, you didn't know for sure what day he would return.
No, we just, and apparently that's not unusual. They they come into the place where they're going to ship him. Yeah, came home on January 3rd.
All right.
Yeah, so, and I on Sunday, January 3rd, I had to go back to work on Monday. He made me go. I was like,
Mondays are hard enough without that.
I know, and here you're, you know, coming off the doing. But anyway, we had our own little Christmas at when he got home, and he out-processed very quickly, and he started school almost like a week later, so it all... You know, it all came together, and that probably, in hindsight, was probably a good thing that we didn't have a lot of time. And I can explain to you how we did get our vacation in, but it was not until quite a bit later. And no, but that was that not knowing exactly when he was coming was very. You know, if he literally called me from, I knew he was en route, and then but he actually called me from McCord, but he was there, and. Had to go pick him up. So,
how far a drive was that?
From McCord Air Force Base is part of, it's now called the McCord Lewis. It's all one big complex.
Right.
And it's not, they're, distance-wise, they're almost exactly the same drive from where I was living. So maybe half an hour.
Mm-hmm. All right. Describe this reunion for me.
You know, that was one of those things I would picture, because you know that they were big on showing reunions and on the news and stuff like that. So you had all this picture of people getting together and running across the airport and all this stuff. No. We met in the back of the bus station in the dark. Well, it wasn't quite dark yet, but it was late afternoon, and it was just the two of us. He came out. He called me, and then he out processed or did what he had to do there, and then so he was waiting for me when I got there, and so it was just the two of us. So it wasn't a big colorful reunion, but boy, it was great. And got home, and first thing he wanted was a shower, so. And I had dinner and everything, because I've been planning this for months, obviously.
Sure.
And so it was, I don't know, it was just like, wow, it's really here. And I knew it was coming, I knew he was on his way home, so I'd had 2 or 3 days of knowing that it was really over, but seeing him there and having him there was just absolutely amazing. And that lasted a long time. I mean, that kind of like, wow, it's really, almost like when we first got married, it's like, oh, he's really here.
Now, you've also mentioned that you were both working from his end and from your end to enroll Tim into graduate school there at Pacific
right.
Lutheran.
Yep.
What, in addition to the, the early out that it would help provide, what was the impetus for this effort to go to graduate school, and how did this work between the two of you? How did you make this happen?
It was, I mean, Tim had always wanted to, I mean, graduate school was the next thing on our calendar for when he got out of the Army. And he'd had that job that he described to you at Bowdoin College the year he graduated, where he worked with the student affairs office and was kind of their student liaison person. They hired somebody for the first two, it's like a two-year position if he stayed, and then as kind of a just graduated student kind of thing, reaching out to other students, and it was, but he really enjoyed it, and he had come out of college not really sure what he wanted to do. He'd applied for a variety of things. He had applied, his major had been art history, and he had applied potentially to an art history program, but wasn't sure he really wanted to do that. He wasn't really sure. He actually had a job offer from one of the lumber companies in Maine, one of the biggies, and they didn't really know if he wanted to do that. His father was a businessman, so he was kind of torn as to where he should go, what he should do. But he really enjoyed that experience at Bowdoin, and liked working with the students, and was pretty good at it. So he decided that's where he wanted to get his master's degree, was in student higher ed administration and student affairs, whatever. I can't remember exactly what the program was called. And PLU had a program. So he applied, and it was interesting. He was actually turned down. He was like a C-plus kind of student at Bowdoin. And people didn't know, on the West Coast, Bowdoin didn't mean anything to them. I mean, you know, all right, so it's one of the little Ivy Leagues. It's not an Ivy League, it's the Little Brothers School,
right,
whatever they called them at that point. And didn't realize that it was a highly competitive, you know, fairly tough school. And so a C-plus wasn't a bad grade average. And he actually had done very well in his major. He actually graduated with honors in his major area, where he was really kind of turned on. So I kind of went back, and I kept saying, well, would you please look at this again? And Tim sent in more documentation. And I think they felt, at least one guy, really felt sympathy toward the military piece of this, that this would be a way to get him home a little early and get him out, and that he did look like a relatively good risk for a graduate student. And so, I can't remember the guy's name. I think it was Sayadachi, but I can't remember for sure. He was the one. There were two or three people that were pretty instrumental for Tim in, at PLU. And so he, back and forth, and I would be the facilitator to get the paperwork to Tim, and then Tim would send it back and forth and all that kind of stuff. So finally he gets accepted. And then the Army says, well, in order to get him an early out, they have to have this certain paperwork from PLU saying that, yes, he's been accepted and this is when he has to start, and to get that right for him. So we had to go through that. And I had to go back to PLU and get them to write the right letter and all this stuff. So eventually we finally did, and it's all documented in my diary. I left. I must have been like, a good couple of months that it took to work through all of that, because you're going back and forth and all that. But it did work out, and he got home and started, the term started, I think, the second week in January. And so he might have been the third, but it was in January anyway. So so that's how it worked. And Tim actually got a graduate assistantship there and worked in there. I think it was the, actually he had several. They had a lot of internships in that program, so he did a number of different things. And then he was hired there for his first job after he graduated.
All right. Now, here comes the inevitable question.
Sorry, what?
An inevitable question coming here. Tim's been gone for roughly a year. You've been taking care of all of these things. You've been away. You make breakfast, lunch, and dinner for yourself. You have
right.
The shower is always available for you. You're on your own for a year. Now this guy comes back, and he's there all the time again. What kind of adjustment, if any, did it take for you two to kind of get used to each other, living together again?
That's an interesting question. I don't remember any, but I'm sure there were. I mean, some things I was probably really glad to give up, like throwing the ball for the dog, and, you know, I didn't, that was fine. I didn't could have that job. I don't know. He's always been very helpful, and you know, we sort of have Martha jobs and Tim jobs. I mean, he does more outside work. I do the laundry, you know, that kind of stuff. But he's always helped with cooking. He's always helped with cleaning. He's always, his mother brought him up right. I've always said she did a good job. So I don't remember that being all that difficult. But it's not like when there's just two of you that life's all that complicated. It got a little more complicated when the kids started coming. But by that point, we were pretty well settled back. I'm trying to think if there was anything that would have, Tim didn't like paying bills, so I don't think he ever took that back. He'd get upset with him, so I just would do it.
Well, I can certainly sympathize with Tim on that one.
Yeah. I mean, we always talked about money. We've been pretty good about that, but it just, you know, the routine stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, another issue that we certainly focus on quite a bit today is the readjustment, as it's called, of soldiers, combat soldiers, returning to civilian life. You mentioned that Tim out-processed very quickly. Now,
Tim
is an
officer. He was out of the Army in 2 days.
Yeah, he was an officer. He was well-educated. He was older than most typical veterans coming back from Vietnam. All of these things are probably working to his advantage in this area. But what about Tim's readjustment? I mean, were there any difficulties that you saw from your end of him being in Vietnam, and then 2 days later he's in the United States and he's out processed and he's free to do what he pleases?
What he wants. I think that, yeah. I mean, I think it, in some ways his going back to school was probably a good transition because he got to be around young people. He got to, it was like, it was basically a counseling higher education program, so he was actually getting a lot of potential support from the faculty that were the, we have several that we've remained in contact with over the years, and I suspect, and though I don't really know, I think they probably kind of watched out to make sure that he, we had like one class, because I took it a year or 2 years later than Tim, where they actually, you had to, it was almost like you were in counseling kind of thing, and he had that, I don't think that first semester, but I, the next year he had to take that course. And so he had opportunities to talk through things and explain some of that. He also had to serve at the veterans, one of the places that you had to do an internship at was at the Veterans Hospital. And Tim actually, I think, really enjoyed that. He, you know, you'd go out and you'd play games with them and stuff like that. But I think it was for him kind of therapeutic in the sense that number one, he realized how lucky he really was, because a lot of these guys were, some of them were old veterans and they had just, you know, moved into the facility, but some of them were not. They, some of them were young men and were either recovering or were there because of the nature of their wounds, probably indefinitely. And so he had that kind of an experience that I think was helpful to him. We had friends who you know, opened right back up to him, and we became, you know, we had a social circle there that was not big, but was steady. And in fact, we haven't had a social circle like that. I mean, because there's something about making friends when you're younger than it's different when you're older, and depending on where we learned that the hard way, but because we move so much. But that group of folks that we knew have continued to be some of our friends that we still correspond with and see. You know, not often, because they're all out west for the most part still, but on occasion. So there was that. His sports, his he picked right up with keeping fit and working out, because he had the university to facilities, and he was a runner. At that point, Tim ran for years and years, and he was like 8-9 miles a day kind of person. So he did that, and I think that probably, he's always said that his exercise was how he, was his mental health treatment. And I truly do believe that that was a huge, and always has been for him. It keeps him, it tires him out. So you can't be too angry if you're all tired out. But, so I'm trying to think what else that we did. And of course I was, you know, I was teaching, and so, I mean, but that was the same life I'd had. So for me, that wasn't
right.
And I was actually in my second year that year with fifth grade, so it was an easier year. First year is always the hardest with a new grade. So at the end of that year is when I did make the transfer, or plan the transfer into special education. So that kind of came up in the later that summer. I actually made this, so the following fall I was in the special education program. But so there was all of those kinds of things that went on. And then we were planning a trip. We, like I say, we had loved our trip across the country, compliments of Uncle Sam, when we moved out there. And we said, well, we need to do two things. One, we need to go visit our parents back east this summer, and we need to do some camping. So Tim bought a, I can't remember the year of our first VW, but like a 68 maybe. It was old, so it might have been even older. Anyway, a VW camper. It was a little tiny one. It didn't have a pop top on it. I'm trying to think. I think it had a refrigerator in it. It had a pull-out bed. Not a lot. Have you ever seen a VW camper?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And we had six of them over the years. I mean, this was the first one. I was very old and very decrepit. The truck drivers, the 18-wheelers, would wave at us as they went by us going up the steep roads. So, I mean, this was really a classical VW. And so he spent his time getting that fixed up. He found it. He bought it. He fixed it up. I made curtains for it. I remember doing that. And we cleaned it and got it organized. And when school was out for me and when school was out for Tim, he didn't take summer courses. I think he maybe took first session, summer session, and so it was like mid-June or somewhere in there. We hit the road, and we took that was, I think, probably one of the smartest things we ever did, because we learned to love it, but it was also very much a time for us, and we had our dog with us. At that point, we had acquired a cat, and we had to... But the person who gave me the cat agreed that, because at that point we already knew we were going to do this trip, that she would take the cat back during the summer while we were gone. As it turns out, I'm highly allergic to cats, so Bummer was our one and only cat. But we drove back east, and we stopped at several national parks on the way, both out and back. We visited several friends along the way. My sister in Missouri, but had just moved to Missouri, and so we saw her. No, she hadn't moved to Missouri yet. I'm sorry, that's later. But we had friends that lived in Missouri, the people from Hawaii, and we saw them. We saw some of our other Army friends on that trip. We spent time in Vermont with my family. We spent time in Massachusetts with Tim's family. And then we drove back. And we were gone, I think it was 6 weeks. 6 to 7 weeks, and got back in time for school and all of that stuff. But it was a great trip, and I look at that as being number one, we did really got into hiking at that point, and we had started doing a lot of that in Washington because of Mount Rainier and the mountains and all around there. So, but this was kind of like a real adventure, and we were camping the whole time in our VW and cooking over the fire, and this was a great trip.
Tim comes home in early 71, and the United States is obviously going to be invested in Vietnam for some time to come here.
Yes, still is.
Did the two of you continue to keep up with what was going on in Vietnam?
Yeah. We talked about it a lot, and Tim came home very much a war is not the answer kind of person. And though he never became really active, I mean, he got out of the Army, and at that point you didn't want people to know you were in the Army or in the military. So his hair started to grow, and we have pictures of him actually back when we moved to Maine in the 70s, when, if you remember, the big Afro look was very in. Tim's hair is very curly, and so he had this huge head of hair. Eventually, that didn't happen until like when did we move back east? 76. So, and that's the picture. I have one picture of him that just shows this like Afro type hair. But that as he got back in 71, 72, 73, he let his hair grow. He didn't have anything to do with the Army. I mean, we didn't really have any friends that we met at Fort Lewis that we continued to we just weren't there. We weren't connected long enough, so that there was no... The people we knew from the Army were the people we had known from OCS, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one guy... Actually, that's not true. Wally and Cheryl, we knew... Tim met them. He met Wally in... he was with the 11th Armored Cav in Vietnam, and he was about 3 or 4 months ahead of Tim. And they became very good friends in Vietnam, and they lived in Seattle. And I actually met Cheryl before Wally came home, and then they had met for Thanksgiving that year, actually. While Tim was still in Vietnam. So.
You've talked about the, you know, or you at least mentioned that this wasn't necessarily a good time to be involved with the military and letting hair grow long and not talking about it, not having anything to do with the Army. Was this something that that you saw as bothering Tim? I mean, here's a guy who did what his country asked him to do, his service, his sacrifice, his leaving his family, his being in combat, all these kinds of things, I think typically would lead someone to be proud of what they've done.
Well,
but this
I think
not
we personally were proud of what he had done, but the country wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those were... Vietnam veterans were not treated well. I'm sorry. You didn't get parades. You didn't get people hanging flags outside for you. You didn't get any of that. It was like, you know, in most cases, people would say, we don't hold it, you made your choice. But there was an awful lot of respect for the people who went to Canada, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, believing what I believe now, I absolutely understand that. But I think we would have made the same decision. But no, the world we're living in at that point in time did not have great respect for the military. Certainly did not have, they certainly didn't have any respect for the war in Vietnam. And they didn't have, therefore, a lot of respect for the soldiers who fought in Vietnam. And it really was not until, what year was the wall first contemplated? That would have been 19, I don't remember. But that's really when Tim began to, that's when he first began to open up a little bit to other people about his experiences. And where it became, I mean, he never denied it. He always put it on his resume. It was never a secret that he served in the military and that, you know, he'd been in Vietnam. But he just didn't, it just wasn't something that you bragged about, I guess might be the right word. I don't know if that's, and it really was not until he didn't come out about it in a very public way until the wall was built. And I think that was like finally something that opened up for him, and he ever since then has been very has reached out a lot about it to others. He's taught classes, he's done a lot of volunteer work. It was after that that he eventually joined the local Purple Heart Association and has done some of that kind of, he got interested in, obviously, in the work you're doing, and part of that's I think age, but part of it was very much that the country did begin to change, and begin to say, oh, maybe we didn't treat these guys so well.
Now, did you see this manifest itself with Tim? Was he bitter about this? Was there any signs of anger or resentment that this was the case of a society not welcoming him or others who went through what he went through?
I'd have to say that I don't ever remember him blaming anyone. And in part, I think it's because he basically agreed that the war was not a war we should have been involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly should have found a way out of it before the 56,000 or whatever number. I mean, he could tell you exactly how many guys are on that wall. And so if he's bitter about anything, it's the fact that all those guys never had a chance to live the life they should have lived. And for a war that really wasn't, I think eventually we'll feel the same way probably about Iraq, but fortunately we didn't lose quite so many people in Iraq, but I think Afghanistan, the country will, I think they'll be angry, I think we are angry that it's gone on for so long, but it still was a war that probably there was some real justification for. Iraq, on the other hand, there wasn't, and a lot of Americans knew it at the time, and certainly all of us know it now. That there was really, but anyway, that's politics. So I won't go there.
Right.
But so if Tim's bitter, it's because, I mean, if the only place I could say I could see him express that, and I would absolutely share that, is with the fact that all of those, for the most part, very young lives, because these were 18, 19, 20 year olds, a lot of them, young draftees, who never really had a chance at life.
You mentioned that there's this kind of a change in Tim's attitude toward the service and things like that. Do you, and you mentioned the wall, do you think the dedication of the Vietnam Memorial would have would have been something that kind of helped push him towards an opening, as it were?
I think the fact that the country finally recognized that that had been, I mean, that was what the whole discussion around the building of the memorial was all about, was, okay, it's time that we said thank you to this group of people. I mean, that's why we have these memorials, is to honor people who have given their lives for their country. And the fact that they did that, and in fact, they did it actually before the Korean one was built. I mean, the Vietnam one actually, well, I think it was a very healing process for this country in terms of coming to grips with separating the soldier from the mission and some of those kinds of concepts. Because I think even today, though, we would argue that Iraq was not a war that should have been fought. We would never, in the same way, we honored those veterans, and we have right from the beginning. I mean, there's still, you can't go anywhere where we're not doing something for our troops, and that's good. I'm not faulting that at all. I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to say. You know, it's important to serve your country, but that doesn't mean we're not going to argue that some of the ways that we're sending you are the right thing to do.
Right.
That the two different arguments there, two different pieces, and that's what happened with, I think, in the whole process of building the wall, the discussions around it was time to put that behind us. And whatever your feelings were about the war, you know, I'll honor the folks who went to Canada. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, Tim had at least one guy in his troop who was a conscientious objector. And he said, you know, the guy, he served, he was a medic, and he served because that was what he had to do, but he didn't give up. You know, he may have not have been a conscientious objector because of the individual war. He may have been a true conscientious objector that just didn't believe in war, period. But I don't know. But anyway, he still did his duty and followed through on it, and he did a fantastic job, so, according to Tim. That's, to me, what the whole wall thing was opening up of that discussion. Now, there may have been a lot of other things going on, too, but that's what, to me, really kind of helped us move forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, Martha, I've got just a couple more questions for you, and they're
okay.
Very broad questions that I typically ask all individuals who I interview. The first one is, as you look back on this time, the Vietnam era, how do you think this time most affected your life personally?
Me personally?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I've already said that. I mean, for me, those years were the years I grew up. I came of age, if you will. I had graduated in 1967. The war had been part of my horizon for at least 2 years prior to that. Probably, I mean, I've been aware of it even before that, but certainly it had been very much an active part of my thinking from about 65, 66 on. And the experiences that I went through as a young wife and then into the Army and all of those kinds of things were very much influenced by our personal experiences going through that. Now, that's, I think, a very separate picture from what I would, you know, in terms of the war itself. I mean, that's a little bit different. I think it absolutely shaped, though, my thinking about the world and my view of the world. And I know it did Tim. And I think, actually, we were pretty fortunate. We've actually grown philosophically, whatever word you want to use, in ways that continue to be fairly close together. Not, we don't totally agree on everything, but we do on most of those kinds of issues, and which makes life pretty much more easy in a lot of ways. But I don't know. I you know, those are the years I grew up. I'm glad I didn't rush right into having a family at age 21. And we adopted our oldest son when I was 27, or he moved in with his foster child at that point. And then our first natural-born child was born when I was 29. So, and of course, by today's standards, that's still young. But in those days, that was getting up there.
Right.
My mother was getting a little worried. And I was ready for that by that point. I mean, that was... So that's, I guess, a very long-winded answer to your question.
No, that's perfectly fine. Well, let me ask you this, then. Last question, and again, this is a question that I ask all of my interviewees, whether they're veterans or family members or whatever.
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
I'm sorry. Last question. As you look back on the Vietnam War, all these things that the Vietnam War is, it was, the lessons we were supposed to have learned, the legacy of the Vietnam War, what, in your opinion, is the legacy of the Vietnam War?
What is the legacy of Vietnam? Well, I'd like to say the legacy was that we had learned that we need to, that you're not going to change the culture of a country, the underpinnings of a country without by going in and fighting a war. But I don't think we've learned that lesson. So I can't say that was a legacy. I guess, at least for now anyway, we have learned that it is important to separate the warrior from the politics, that supporting your country is important, right or wrong kind of thing, which doesn't mean that you don't tell them that they're wrong, but it does mean that you don't, that you continue to honor those that do serve and respect the choices that people make around those kinds of issues. I would see that as a legacy that right now is holding and hopefully will for the foreseeable future. I think it also opened up our eyes a little bit to how big the world really is, but yet how small it really is. In terms of, and that may be not so much Vietnam as what's been happening in the last, I mean, our world has gotten smaller and smaller as technology and all these things bring us closer and closer together. But on the other hand, there's more and more people, there's more and more issues that we have to deal with on a, not just on a countrywide basis, but on a global wide world if we're going to solve some of these issues. So I guess that's, we were moving in that direction. I mean, when you look back, Vietnam was really our first experience into, as in recent times anyway, into a part of the world that most of us knew nothing about.
Right.
We were very Eurocentral in the United States, at least in my growing up years we were. And, of course, you had the Pacific World War II theater, but... I have to say that would be a lot of why we ended up in Vietnam, wouldn't it?
Certainly, certainly a lot of strings attached to that.
But it didn't. It's taken. I don't think I was as aware. Of course, I didn't live through World War II. I was born right at the end of it. But it was still much more talked about as the European theater and the Pacific theater until, for me anyway, in terms of my early years. Now I understand the importance of what went on in the Pacific Theater, but at that I can remember thinking that it was all Hitler.
Well, Martha, is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we close it out?
I don't think so. I have to say I think you are an excellent interviewer, and you make it very easy. I think I ramble a little too much, so I apologize for people who have to listen to this.
Not at all. Well, okay, then let's go ahead and put a stop to the interview.